Hello and welcome to this very special edition of Civiline Insights. I'm Gareth Westwood, Head of Global Intelligence here at Civiline, and today I'm honoured to be joined by former senior diplomat Sir Laurie Brister. Laurie entered diplomatic service in 1990 and his impressive resume includes Ambassador to Azerbaijan, UK's Ambassador to Russia, Ambassador to Afghanistan, as well as key roles within the COP environment and within the Foreign Office, including Director for National Security and Intelligence. So Laurie, welcome and thank you very much for coming to Civiline.
Thanks very much for the invitation.
So you obviously gained some fame during the fall of Afghanistan. Many of our listeners and viewers will recognise you from various news bulletins on the TV during that fateful summer. However, before we get on to that, what have you been up to since leaving the Foreign Service?
Yeah. Well, of course, it's not necessarily the fame that, or the sort of fame that you would want to acquire. But yes, I left the Foreign Office about 18 months ago and headed off back to Cambridge, where I was an undergraduate and a postgraduate student, to head up Hughes Hall. Hughes Hall is now one of the bigger colleges in Cambridge, mostly postgraduate and postdoctoral students, but a fair number also of mature undergraduates. And it's a college that has a particular interest in research translation, so applying academic research and knowledge to real world problems.
Sounds absolutely fascinating. And of course, we'll get on to some of the climate stuff later, but there is a heavy climate element to that college, am I right?
That's right, yeah. So we've got a Centre for Climate Engagement, which works with non-executive directors on listed company boards to help them think about the low carbon transition.
Sounds very much like a Civiline friendly venture. Really fascinating. I bet it's a wonderful honour to be now president of a college in the university that you attended. However, I think we shall go on to Afghanistan to start off with, if we may. I know our listeners will be aching to hear a little bit more about your role. Now we will get into obviously the run up to the drawdown and the collapse of Kabul, following peace deal. However, you took over from Ambassador Blake. What were your impressions of the security forces, the state of the peace deal, the state of play when you arrived?
Sure. Well, I took over from Allison in June 2021. So as it turned out, a couple of months before the final collapse. But to say that I'd been briefed going into the job would be quite an understatement. I'd been appointed to the job the previous autumn. And had spent most of the intervening time really working on a couple of things. You know, one was trying to map through with colleagues in London and elsewhere what we thought would happen as the military drawdown, the military withdrawal took place, but also to work on our contingency planning, what it would take to keep an embassy there and able to function at a time when the military had basically withdrawn, and what if it all went wrong, which of course is what happened. So maybe to backtrack a little bit, I mean, some of the key moving parts in that. The Doha deal between the Trump administration and the Taliban had been signed in February 2020. And that deal committed the US and allied forces to leave Afghanistan by May 2021. There was a lot of dissent around the system, US as well as the UK, about whether that was the right move, but that was President Trump's decision. Fast forward, you then got the election the new administration at the beginning of 2021. Mr. Biden's views on the military presence in Afghanistan were well known. He'd been talking about it for many years. But there was a very brief period of a review. So the Biden administration took a moment, actually took until April, decided what to do, and decided basically to stick with the Taliban, the deal with the Taliban at Doha, and continue with the military drawdown. So as I was preparing to go out to Afghanistan, we were trying to work through the implications of that. Should we still have an embassy there? How do we have an embassy there? Remember, it's still got work to do on the counterterrorism side, on supporting the government, and of course, making sure that we are withdrawing, we're relocating the people who've worked for us over 20 years who are going to be at risk as a result of having worked for us.
So just to follow on that then, was there an acceptance that the Taliban were likely or highly likely to form the main body, or indeed the entirety of the Afghanistan government following the withdrawal? Yeah.
So there was a range of scenarios about what would happen. Governments, our government, the UK government, like most organisations, does its scenario planning, tries to work out what's the most optimistic, reasonable scenario and the reasonable worst case scenario, and where do you think you're going to land on that spectrum. We all thought, I think, that it was quite a tall order that the Afghan government would survive in its current form indefinitely. What I think nobody expected was the speed and the totality of the collapse. So you remember also, for a lot of that time, under the terms of the Doha deal, there was a political negotiation, more stop than start, but the Doha deal did envisage a political negotiation between the government of Afghanistan and the Taliban. To be perfectly honest, I think that was an exercise in optimism, that the Taliban would negotiate seriously and that a political settlement would be achievable under those circumstances. But that was the plan.
And, you know, we have shared experience in Afghanistan. I remember well the tactical failures on the ground at the time that compounded the whole issue. But stepping back, you know, in your role as the ambassador, what, on reflection, what do you think were the key successes and failures in the immediate run-up to what was the withdrawal?
So it's really hard to describe any of this as a success. I think there is one thing I would want to put right up front as a success of sorts. It's that because of the planning that we had done, the UK government with the military and with other parts of our system, we were able to get out 15,000 people, actually more than 15,000 people in under 2 weeks. It's good for those people that we did. It's not so good for the people that got left behind. So I think, you know, we need to be really honest with ourselves about the nature and the consequences of the failures that took place. I think the really big picture here, though, is how did we get from where we were in 2001 to where we ended up in 2021? So the after the attacks of 9/11 in 2001, US-led Western forces supported the Northern Alliance to displace the Taliban, and 20 years later, the Taliban are back via a 20-year campaign. I think it's a pity that there hasn't been more public debate about why, but I think, you know, we have to recognize, we, the UK, the US, our allies, we need to understand and recognize the failures of strategy and policy that got us there.
Yeah, absolutely bewildering, I think. From my standpoint, you know, anybody who's read Stephen Call's Ghost Wars, just compressed the timeline quite considerably, and you have a rough idea of what happened. But I mean, beyond kind of non-fiction literature, we actually have an MOD document that was written slightly after the Iraq War that, well, it could have frankly been a lessons learned document that could have been written after the drawdown of Kabul. Do you want to just bring out some highlights?
Sure. So this I think, may be of interest to your audience working in pretty much any line of business or any organization. So I was doing a lecture a couple of weeks ago on how you advise ministers in a crisis. And one of the things I pulled out to prepare for that is an MOD document called The Good Operation. So it was published in 2018. You can easily find it on the internet. And it's one of the lessons learned documents from the Chilcot inquiry into the Iraq invasion and what followed. And I was just looking through this thing. There's a headline that says, "Are you ready? This is your guidance going into planning or executing an operation." So what should you do to be ready? Build insufficient challenge, diversity of thought, critical thinking to head off groupthink. Make time to think, make time to reflect so that you're thinking properly, strategically. Draw on previous expertise and experience, the people who've done something similar before. And make sure you've got channels for ground truth rather than hearing what you want to hear from the people who know what you want to hear. A few things about, you should be concerned if the real world is sending you the following signals. First, the desired end state looks increasingly unachievable. There's divergence between what's actually happening and understanding of it at strategic decision-making level. There's a gap between public rhetoric and our ability to deliver. The bit where you start getting really worried is if your own decision-making is displaying any of the following tendencies. Groupthink. No one's applying critical thinking. You're working off a best-case scenario. The strategy is weak or poorly articulated. Effective decision-making is impaired by structures, processes, or institutional tribalism. Excessive self-confidence or inertia. And the timescales for decision-making are being set by the politics rather than by the real world. Last one, which I may come back to in a minute, you're not stopping doing things that aren't working. Does that remind you of anything?
Wow. I mean, there's so much to unpack there, and that could have been a précis of what happened following the peace deal, and actually probably a little bit before that, right? The writing was maybe on the wall in the late 2010s, possibly, in certain parts of the Afghan security forces. But, okay, so just to unpack a bit of that, I mean, groupthink. Mm-hmm. At least one of the cognitive biases that you learn week one, day one, if anybody's done any military intelligence training or you know, anything in the civil service. That groupthink with that kind of collective optimism, in my view, stifled the ability to get that ground truth up the chain. Why do you think that was in place? I mean, the cynic would say, oh, people wanted to, you know, get this award or get that award. I don't buy that. But there was something at the heart of it in which, you know, ground truth, which was being relayed in certain channels, wasn't getting heeded by, I guess, policymakers. What do you think's at the heart of that?
Yeah. So I think the place to start on that is don't be too much of a hurry to impute bad motives to people. Most of the people I've worked with most of the time have been trying to do their best with the situation they've got. I think there are a couple of things I draw out from the Afghanistan campaign. One is, is this a military problem or a political problem? That's something I think, I mean, looking back over the 20 years, and I explore this at some length in a book I've got coming out fairly shortly on why it happened as well as what it felt like at the time. Why is it that we kept applying military force in circumstances where, looking back on it, that could not possibly get you to the right answer? Because the right answer is a political settlement, and a viable political settlement, by definition, involves those Afghans from whom the Taliban draw their strength, so particularly the Pashtun population. There was never, I think, a viable plan to get there. And of course, in the early stages of the Afghanistan campaign, it wasn't politically realistic, particularly in the US, to say you have got to negotiate with the Taliban. That is the way forward. By the time we did get to that realization, and by the time it was crystallized in the Doha deal in February 2020, it was far too late, but also it was structured in a way that was almost guaranteed to produce failure, because what we're saying to the Taliban is, we're out of here militarily. And they not unnaturally look at that and say, okay, fine, we'll wait. Why on earth would you negotiate with a government that wasn't even party to the Doha deal if you know that your military opponent and the underpinning that they provide to the Afghan government is going to leave on a timetable?
It's so, you know, bizarre that that lesson wasn't learned from Obama did the same thing with the surge, etc. Absolutely staggering. But as you said, it's from the very early days, right? The engagement was politically not palatable, but as early as 2002, we had the opportunity to negotiate with the Taliban. And does this say something wider about interventionism, or is it folly to try and, you know, get one intervention and paste the lessons onto another intervention that could be in a different part of the world?
Yeah. So this has really been one of the sort of continuing themes of my 30 plus years in the Foreign Office. I joined the Foreign Office in 1990. You know, the Cold War was ending far more benignly than we expected. And I left the Foreign Office in 2022. I mean, you can fill in the sentence, yeah. You know, the year in which the Cold War or something like it really got going again. Mm. Well, actually, to put it more accurately, I think the focus of governments like ours, the US, pivoted very much back to great power competition. And that, of course, is part of the context of the decision to draw down the military forces in Afghanistan. So when President Biden was talking about the challenges faced by the US and its allies in the 21st century and focused on great power competition, things like climate change, it was the aftermath of COVID, he wasn't wrong. in my view. The problem was, how do you get from that analysis to a stable, viable future, to this this campaign in which you've invested so much and so many lives over 20 years? And if you get it wrong, what's the impact on the other things you're trying to achieve? So the humiliation of that, you know, that withdrawal, the collapse of the Afghan government, and the hurried withdrawal from Afghanistan.
And there's so many lessons, I guess, from before we leave Afghanistan, and probably a neat little segue here, but there are so many lessons to learn from this that, you know, arguably we should have learned in past conflicts, but whether that be the peace deal itself, the conduct of the conflict, you know, soft power, hard power, but also I think, you know, those who think this is just a regionally contained issue, a failure that, you know, led to some humiliation with no further repercussions, I think they're misguided, because, you know, is it fair to say, and we'll get onto Russia in a moment, but Putin was emboldened by this and saw it as a microcosm for kind of the failure, the downfall of the West.
Yeah. So there are much, much bigger things going on here. I mean, just to be very clear, I don't think that Putin's decision to invade Ukraine in you know, the beginning of 2022 was basically made for him by the withdrawal from Afghanistan. I think it was a factor.
Right.
And I think what he saw looking at that was a weakness of the will in even understanding, let alone the West standing up for its interests. The thing that I find very interesting here, I mean, we were just talking now before starting about the outlook for 2024. I cannot remember a time where there's been more turbulence and risk in the international environment than now. And I think, as you say, part of that is around, it's the intersection of a number of things. It's the volume and the cumulative effects of variants of state failure around the world. It's the unfinished business that we were trying to deal with in Afghanistan around violent extremism. This has not gone away. Yeah. But also the consequences of that. You know, we need to think more systemically about these things. If we're worried about, as we are, the politics of people turning up in small boats on the English Channel, we've got to think about why those people move. What are the things that drive them? Whether it's conflict or poverty or the hope of a better life or whatever it is. But, you know, that's the kind of debate I think we need to have here. Otherwise, we will be forever trying to deal with the consequences rather than trying to address causes up front. The great power competition thing, again, I think is important, because it's extraordinary how far and fast we've swiveled back to a world that we thought we'd left behind, one where there is a clear standoff between the democracies, the Western democracies, and authoritarian regimes of different sorts. But maybe the difference between now and the Cold War that I grew up in is the countries of the middle ground. Mm. So countries like, for example, India is one I find very interesting. Clearly a democracy, clearly not planning to align with the West anytime soon. I think we need to ask ourselves, why is that? How do they understand their interests? How do they coincide with ours? How do they conflict with ours? Or how do they not align with ours? And what are we going to do about it? Simply saying, we're right, we're democracies, the rules-based international order is the best possible answer, and expecting people to get with the program, it's not going to work.
That's really intriguing. And before we get onto Russia, let's sort of unpack that. I mean, what do you think are the levers to get the likes of India on our side? And were we naive forever thinking that we, you know, we could, as opposed to rent the loyalty, to rent the loyalty of these underlying countries, we thought we could buy them. We thought we could possess that. And actually, it was always transactional.
So a couple of things here that I find myself increasingly thinking about and working on. One is, I mean, it's worth saying, even though it's so obvious, it's negotiation 101. When you're going into a discussion or a negotiation with somebody, you need to get inside what they want as well as what you want. You know, you don't need to think about that for very long to understand that their hierarchy of interests may be different from yours. So simply saying, here's what we want, you know, more or less polite versions of hand it over, it's not going to get you very far. To take, for example, India, I mean, this is one of the world's emerging powers of the 21st century, huge economic power, huge science and technology power, very interesting to, of course, a university and a college of the sort that I now work in, because that's where a lot of the intellectual capital of the 21st century will be created. Not quite sure what its size, shape, or role is in the 21st century. But they have their own history. It's not particularly comfortable with regard to the UK in particular. But also, if you look at it as, for example, a foreign or security policy question, what's the biggest thing on their agenda? One of the biggest things on their agenda is China.
Yeah.
And, you know, managing this very, very difficult relationship with the other emerging power of the 21st century. Another is access to resources, access to energy, access to food, access to intellectual capital, you name it. And so I think what we're seeing there is my second point. It's about, I touched earlier on the rules-based international order. I mean, the risk of grossly oversimplifying. The rules-based international order that we've got at present largely reflects the interests and the views of the West. First of all, post-1945 and preeminently post-Cold War. That world has gone. And I'm not sure that, you know, we really have quite hoisted on board what that means yet. So an example from the field of climate change. You know, we have this structure, a UN-focused structure, the UN Convention, Framework Convention on Climate Change, lots and lots of agreement, a clear global consensus that this is urgent and important and, you know, we're all in it. But part of the debate here is around who pays the costs of the transition. And if essentially what the industrialized West and countries like Russia is saying to the global South is, you know, we've built our economies on a high carbon economy. You're not. You're going to build your economy on a low carbon economy. You know, good luck with the costs of that. It's not really a recipe for bringing people with you.
No, and you talk about negotiation. I mean, I can't imagine a more difficult negotiating environment than your role in Russia as ambassador there. And if we can just pivot towards towards Russia. You were ambassador during the period of Crimean annexation, I believe, and the annexation of parts of the east of Ukraine.
So I spent a lot of time working on Russia. So I was the deputy ambassador there at the time of the Georgia invasion in 2008. Much of my time as deputy, we were dealing with the you know, the tail end of the Litvinenko murder in London. So this is where, just to remind people who may have forgotten, this is where the FSB sent a hit squad to London to kill a guy in London using polonium, you know, put in his tea. Most of the decade after that was spent dealing with the emerging conflict in Ukraine. And then, of course, I was back in Moscow when the GRU, the military intelligence, sent another hit squad to paint a nerve agent on someone's door handle in Salisbury. That was the Skripal case. Dealing with Russia for much of that time really, though, wasn't as simple as that. Going back to the immediate post-Cold War period, what we were trying to do, essentially, for most of those two and a half decades, was to find ways of binding Russia into a more cooperative relationship with us, with the West, with our institutions, on a win-win basis. I still don't think that that was the wrong approach. It didn't work, and we need to understand why. We need to understand what happened in Russia that caused that to fail. But the idea that you could move from a highly confrontational relationship with the Soviet Union to a more cooperative win-win relationship with Russia still seems to me to be a good outcome if we can get it. But I don't think that's now available for probably another generation at least. And it's certainly not available while Mr. Putin is in power.
Sure. And, you know, you said you did quite a lot of work, a huge amount of work on Russia, all the way from back Georgia, Litvinenko, through to Skripal, through to the annexation, through to, you know, Putin's speech in Munich 2007, where he told us what was going to happen. So did the invasion then in 2022... Yep. Come as any surprise to you?
So just going back to Munich, so the Munich Security Conference speech, I still recommend to people starting to study Russia as the best guide you will get to how the world sees through Mr. Putin's eyes. And going back to something I was saying earlier about understanding your opponent, it is absolutely essential to try to understand what is happening through the eyes of a now 70-something ex-KGB man whose formative experiences were the end of the Soviet Union and the collapse of the Soviet Union. Doesn't mean you agree with it, but you need to understand it, because otherwise you won't understand what he's doing and why and make good policy. I think what I would say about 2022 is the fact that he says what he thinks does not mean necessarily that he's telling you what he will do. They're two separate things. And bear in mind also that Mr. Putin is somebody who systematically uses lying as an instrument of statecraft. You call it maskirovka, call it whatever you want, but he is not a man who will tell you his intentions. I looked at the build-up the end of 21, beginning of 22, thinking this is extremely dangerous. But I couldn't quite bring myself to believe he would actually send in the hundred thousand plus soldiers that he did into Ukraine, because it didn't make sense to me, nor did I believe that they would make such a mess of it. Mm. So it's the failures of that campaign, particularly in the early stages, tell us something about the nature of the regime we're dealing with. We endlessly circle back, though, to this point about our cognitive biases, seeing what you want to see rather than what you're actually seeing, and putting the construction on those things that you want to put on it rather than the one that, with hindsight, the evidence points you towards.
Yeah, and we certainly saw that in the lead-up to the invasion, friends in government going around various states saying this is going to happen. And it was almost a failure of imagination to believe that this irrational action could take place, but it did. You say it's been not quite a disaster, a catastrophe. It's, I think, Russia may be on the upper hand at the moment, but certainly it's you put in your recent Prospect magazine that Putin was that Putin was weakened by his own actions and the actions of others. Is Putin's regime under threat should the war go back towards tilting towards a Ukrainian victory of sorts?
So first of all, to explain what I mean by the strategic catastrophe for Russia that this war represents. I mean, first of all, obviously the failures of the military campaign. They expected, they planned to walk into Kiev in a small number of days and basically impose a Russia-friendly regime and absorb Ukraine back into their sphere of influence and keep it out of the West. That didn't work. I don't think it now can work, whatever the outcome of the war is. And the price that Russia has paid and will pay for that is a number of things. First of all, they have essentially revitalized NATO and its sense of purpose. So we went in a very short period of time from the near-death experience that NATO had maybe 4 years ago to one where what is at stake and our means for dealing with it is now front and center. Sweden and Finland got straight in the queue, very, very capable allies. They've been neutral for generations, with good reason. Their strategic calculations completely turned around. Internally, the Russian economy is not breaking anytime soon. It's actually growing at the moment. But its sources of long-term competitiveness, its ability to regenerate, are basically gone. I mean, this is now a rent economy built on oil and gas. And the impact on the political economy has been very severe. So again, I do not see any circumstances anytime soon where Mr. Putin is overthrown, either from the street or from within. What we are clearly seeing, though, here now is a system that really is completely at a loss as to how to manage the transition of power when the time comes, as it surely will.
Well, yeah, that's literally my next question, Laurie. Biology at some point will play a part. You will get thrown out by biology, I guess. And he is aging. He's in his 70s. Can't last forever, despite the fact that he'll highly likely win the next election with a probably 110% share of the vote. Who knows? But what comes after Putin, in all seriousness? And you said a we won't be able to align as we once wanted to for a generation. Do you see what comes after Putin has been worse?
Yeah. So let's deal with the election first. There's an election in March in which there is essentially one voter and one candidate. I don't find it hard to predict the outcome of that. Simply putting it in those terms, I think, slightly misunderstands what it's about. It's about revalidating Putin's rule and direction for what happens next. And I think this year is really set to be an extremely dangerous year for all concerned. So, the Ukrainian counteroffensive last summer didn't deliver the effects that they were looking for, that we were looking for. That doesn't mean to say it's all over. I think we're now in a situation where the determinants here are around the staying power of the US and of Europe in terms of our ability and willingness to support Ukraine in terms of armaments, material, money, political support. And as you're seeing, both of those there's a degree of doubt around them. We're going into a US election. And again, I think it's entirely obvious what Mr. Putin's strategy there is. It's play for time, see what we get this time next year. If it's a Trump presidency, I think Putin's calculation in a nutshell is, let's see if Mr. Trump is up for what he says he is, which is let's do a deal. I mean, the nature of that deal, I think, just bears thinking about in the intervening time. But there's also everything else. So you've got what's happening in the Middle East, in Gaza, around Iran. You've got the anxieties around Taiwan and China. There's an awful lot of heat in the system. And if I were in the Kremlin, I would be betting on that taking away political bandwidth, oxygen, resources from this fundamentally important conflict in Central Eastern Europe.
And, on that, what, if anything, comes after yeah. Putin then? When we were talking last year, we were trying to red team scenarios. When it looked like he could be thrown, accidentally fall out of an 8-floor window. The conclusion was, what could come after Putin in the current political environment is Putin 2.0 worse than Putin? Yeah. Putin and even more Putin, not to exhaust the metaphor. So what do you think comes after, whether he is, if he dies of old age or has a health scare in the meantime?
Yeah. So again, it's really important to do our scenario planning here, but not to put unrealistic weight on the scenarios. The scenario that I essentially rule out is a kind of velvet revolution, so a democratic uprising leading to a clear trajectory to democracy. I just don't see how that can happen anytime soon from where Russia is at present. The risk, the big risk for the Russian leadership that they all know about is an unplanned, unmanaged transition, which is a polite way of saying he doesn't wake up one morning, death of Stalin type scenario. It could happen. There's not much I can sensibly say about that other than to identify it. I think the scenario that we should all be focusing on is when and how they do a managed transition. By definition, that will be a managed transition at a time of Putin's choosing to a person or persons of Putin's choosing. And that will be about consolidating what Putin's however many terms by then have all been about. So a highly authoritarian view of Russia that's essentially imperialist, in my view, and trying to keep the system stable. The bit that I find intriguing in all this is that I don't find it hard to imagine a scenario where Mr. Putin's successors, who will have probably a similar view on the world to Putin, will look at the mess that they've created in Russia as well as in Ukraine, and not unnaturally they'll be thinking about ways out of that mess. So not coming to us and saying, look, we've made a terrible mistake, that's just unreal, but looking for ways to find some sort of off-ramp, some sort of settlement that enables them to say, okay, right, we've won. It's I think actually actively dangerous for Western politicians to talk about that at present, but it is just worth thinking through. If the opportunity arose to de-escalate this this conflict on terms that are acceptable to us and on terms acceptable to Ukraine, what might that look like?
Really interesting question that I think we're constantly asking ourselves here. We haven't got an answer yet.
I don't think there is one yet. But of course, the time factor comes in because it goes into this question of a negotiation. So there's a lot of discussion, a lot of loose talk, I think, at present about get the Ukrainians into a negotiation. Negotiate about what? So the Ukrainians know what a negotiation under duress looks like. That was what happened in 2013, 2014, into 2015, the Minsk agreements. Yeah. That's the kind of deal that you cut when you have literally no option. I think that, you know, to turn this around, if we think that at some stage this ends in a negotiation this time round, what are the circumstances in which the Ukrainians will look at that and say, this is an okay to good option now to pursue our fundamental goals through negotiation rather than on the battlefield? That's the situation I think that we need to get into.
And so if we get a Biden outcome in the election and there's continued Western support for Ukraine and Mr. Putin continues to wake up in the morning, how do we get there? What does that look like? How does it end? How do we get to a place where we can negotiate? Or is this going to be a protracted, a 10-year war?
Yeah. But to take your last point first, I think, you know, we need to be prepared for this to be a long war. Because as I was saying earlier, as I said in the Prospect article, I don't see Mr. Putin's and therefore Russia's fundamental objectives here changing, whatever happens on the battlefield, because they're not all about Ukraine and Ukrainian territory. They're mostly about Russia and about us and Russia's standing with relation to the West. It's essentially, I think, about who is the dominant military power in Europe. So I hope that helps to answer the question. What do we need to achieve here? What we need to achieve is that Russia does not become the dominant military power in Europe, that they do not become the people who set the terms of that, that they are not seen to gain a tangible political, economic, territorial advantage from the war that they launched.
And do we see a world kind of flipping the coin a little bit here, where Russia does achieve some kind of victory, be that with Ukraine negotiating under duress or whether Trump negotiates with an adversary without consulting Ukraine, almost reminiscent of the Afghan peace deal. Is there a world in which Russia, emboldened by a victory, treads foot onto a NATO country?
Yeah. So I don't see Russia winning the war in Ukraine outright. I do not see how they can get from where they are now to full occupation, basically bringing Ukraine back into their orbit. It's not going to happen. As regards a direct attack on a NATO country, well, a couple of things to say there. First of all, the Russian state, their military planners know perfectly well what the Article 5 guarantee is, and they know perfectly well where direct conflict between Russia and NATO leads. So deterrence works, and deterrence has worked throughout this war. It's been fascinating to watch how both sides, and actually in one of the few positive things to come out of all this, has been watching how both sides have been very, very careful for this not to become a direct Russia-NATO military confrontation, because it's in neither side's interests for that to happen, certainly not in Russia's interests. That said, Russia will, of course, continue to do what it's done for many years, which is to test the thresholds. So, for example, the cyber attacks on Estonia, attacks on political systems, use of information operations, use of special services and all the rest of it. Why would that change? Mm. The point here is that, the Russian state tends to operate in a field where it has comparative advantage over us, and that's one of those fields. They got it wrong in Ukraine. But what I'm saying is that I think it's, of course, we should take these things very seriously, because the consequences of direct Russia-NATO confrontation, military confrontation, are very, very dangerous for all concerned. But I don't see it happening because of the scale of the misjudgments that it would involve.
And just to steelman that, obviously we've talked about the US election quite a bit in the podcast so far. We're covering it extensively here at Sibylline. Donald Trump has said before he, want to withdraw from NATO, whatever that means, whether it means actually withdrawing from NATO or just unaligning itself with regional allies and partners. There's, among the commentary, there's a thought that this time Trump might not be surrounded by folks that would resist this, and maybe surround himself with yes men. Now he's had, one bite of the cherry already. would Russia's calculations vis-a-vis, you know, walking into a NATO country change should Donald Trump win and follow through on some of the things that he, the more bellicose things he said about NATO?
Yeah. So I find it really not terribly useful for my own purposes to try and second guess what a Trump presidency might do. I just don't know.
Sure.
He's such an unpredictable, unknown quantity for, you know, if your background is in foreign policy, security policy. I think the point that I would want to underline here, though, is to think about what are the political forces on which Mr. Trump feeds. Yeah. Maybe the most helpful way to explain that is how and why did it get to the stage in, I think it was about 2018, where there was a clear rift starting to open up amongst the Western allies about the utility of the alliance. That's on us. I think, you know, we, meaning the UK, Germany, France, the other European allies, need to be very, very clear about why this alliance matters to us and to the US and what we're prepared to put into our own collective defense. That seems to me to be the core of this discussion with any incoming US administration. Bearing in mind, you know, the evident facts that, you know, if you are the president of the United States, you've got more than one thing on your mind in the next 5 years.
And just before we leave Russia, we're up against time. We need to close off with a few finishing questions. But obviously, the Center for Climate Engagement, we talked about that at the very outset, helps non-exec directors support and guide company boards through the low carbon transition. Linked to energy and the Russia question, we've done a lot of reporting on the European energy crisis. How would you measure the impact of this conflict on food, energy security?
So this is probably the point to try and bring together a number of things. So the Center for Climate Engagement in my college, as you said, you know, works with non-executive directors to try and help them think through with their boards the answer to the question, have we still got a company the other side of the low carbon transition? How do we get there? How do we thrive in the economy that we're going into? That seems to me to be a pretty good use of research and of the thinking power that universities have, you know, to help the private sector think through those kinds of questions and more. Underlying that, particularly from my background, there's a question here about what actually security is in the 21st century. So again, the trajectory of my career has gone from great power competition, the Cold War, through back to great power competition via failed states and the consequences of failing states and extreme ideologies and so on. To go back to President Biden's stated reasons for withdrawing the military from Afghanistan, one of the things that he mentioned was climate change. Another of the things he mentioned was COVID, you know, global pandemics. There are these security threats and risks that for many years people like me didn't even really think about as primarily security risks. Well, they are. And you know, this is one of the things I think that we've had to hoist on board in recent years. And all these risk registers in government that, you know, envisage terrorist attacks, state on state, conflict, you name it. The most damaging thing that happened in recent memory was the COVID pandemic. The biggest thing that will probably happen in our lifetimes is the cost of climate change, also the risks of climate change. What we don't yet have, I think, is the tools and mechanisms for collective action against that. That I think is really an urgent priority in the coming years. Coming back to the Ukraine conflict, or the conflict in Ukraine, Russia's invasion of Ukraine, is of course not driven by climate change pressures. It's driven by good old-fashioned geopolitics and imperialism. But there are factors involved in here. So take the Black Sea grain deal. Very, very important, huge impact, particularly on the global south, of the spike in food prices last year, because Ukrainian grain and fertilizer was not making it to global markets. Turned out that part of the answer to that was Ukraine, through some really smart, astute military action in the Black Sea, basically neutralizing the Russian threat to that. Climate change, you know, there are... Russia is a huge oil and gas producer. At some stage, the country will need to make the transition from that to a low-carbon economy. We were starting to have this discussion with Russia over the last maybe decade or so. That discussion is now off the table, but it has to happen at some stage.
We're going to move on quickly, I think, because time is against us, and we've probably got very low batteries on our microphones by now. I think one of the most fascinating roles, personally, I thought you did in doing your career in government was Director of Intelligence National Security, essentially overseeing the, you know, the nation's intelligence architecture. Absolutely fascinating. Also, you know, you've written a lot about crisis management. We was talking about how you did the withdrawal from Afghanistan and the difficulty of comms. And of course, you know, whilst government has access to all kinds of exquisite information at high classifications, often in crisis, you need information that is releasable, especially if you work with foreign partners. You know, how do you see the role of open source intelligence in these kind of crisis situations?
Going back to what I was talking about earlier, so the Good Operation 2018, open source is it's this huge ocean of stuff out there that people have chosen to put out there. Some of it's really, really good. Some of it's rubbish. Some of it's disinformation. Some of it is actively untrue. And you know, it's out there in order to mislead you. You know, for some of the jobs I've done, you know, I've come across a great deal of state-on-state or state-on-society disinformation. Disinformation is another word for lying. Mm. So, you know, we need to be clear about what we're talking about here. At the other end of the spectrum, very secret intelligence. You know, I'm not going to talk about any of the detail of it, but again, going back to this, what did we learn from the invasion of Iraq? One of the things I hope we learned is test the evidence in front of you. Go back to the Chilcot inquiry, the dodgy dossier, all of that stuff. Why did we think X was true when it turned out X was not true, or partially true, or not the whole story? And I come back really to the habits of mind for decision makers and their advisors. One of the things I have more than my fair share of opportunity need to think about in recent years is those old things, cognitive biases. So why do we think what we think? How do we know it's true? What else might be going on that we just don't know about? How do you access that? So the things that I always come back to are groupthink. Unerring ability of groups of like-minded people to tell themselves that what they think is true is actually true. Things like optimism bias. So in Afghanistan, we went from our reasonable worst case scenario through to our absolutely nightmare scenario in about a day. Sure. You know, just worth thinking about, you know, how that process works. The other one, of course, going back to groupthink, is confirmation bias. I remember almost my last conversation with Hanif Atmar, the Afghan foreign minister, asking him in front of a group of Western ambassadors. He understood perfectly well why I was asking, and you'll find out why in a minute. What would you recommend we do? This was about 3 weeks before the fall of Kabul. His answer, which is ringing in my ears, is stop making the same mistakes, expecting different results.
That's a definition of madness, is it not? No, that's really fascinating. And of course, you know, the explosion in open source information clearly means that businesses and organizations need a company to create that information, analyze it, and push out the necessary reporting, whereas, of course, where Sibylline comes in. Laurie, it's been an absolute pleasure to have you on board and welcome you to Sibylline Towers. Just a final thought from you. If anybody, any of our listeners and viewers out there was thinking of going into the Foreign Service, you know, or maybe fascinated by your national security background, or eventually wanted him to become the ambassador for the UK and Russia, what piece of advice would you give them as they're doing their university studies now? Yep.
So I never give people careers advice, and of course I get asked for it all the time. Ambassador to Russia, those sorts of jobs, you know, if that's not what you want, you're in the wrong organization, really. But only you know what you actually want. So people like you or me can help you work out what the answer to that question is and how to get it if that is what you want. But the place to start is, you know, what do you actually want? What motivates you?
I think that's a wonderful note to end on. Laurie Bristow, thank you very much for coming on the podcast.
Thank you.
Well, thank you for joining us on this very special edition of Sibylline Insights. We really look forward to welcoming you back the next time round. Please remember to like and subscribe.